Right, here we are. After a while with the 28th Battalion in these trenches, I got word from my uncle that he had arranged a transfer for me to join his unit, the 1st CMRs. Well, I'd been in hospital with the flu or something, and when I came out, this transfer was awaiting me. So I was given the thing and told to go and join the 1st CMR. Of course, I had no idea where they were, nobody knew. I just had to find out, you see. So I went off, and I finally got to a place called Newlam Means, I think. And who should I see up the top of a telegraph pole but my brother, who was in the signal corps, and he was fixing up some telephone line.
Not for goodness sake.
So he came down after he'd finished his job, and I spent the night with him in a barn, and we got some champagne and some stout, and that made black velvet. So we got in this barn and we drank black velvet that evening. And I remember there was a fella, his companion, a fella called Dyke. I don't know what he'd been in England, but he drank black velvet with us, but we both of us got fairly well lit up, you know. And this private Dyke of the Canadian Corps of Signals treated us like a couple of young gentlemen. He made our bed for us, and he put us to bed, and he covered us up and made sure that everything was all right for, you know, you know, you'd think that we were two young gentlemen being looked after by a servant.
Yes.
And he was just another soldier.
Yeah. That was very kind of him, I suppose.
It was very kind of him.
Yeah.
However, I finally found my way to the 1st CMRs, and the colonel was away, and my uncle happened to be second in command then, commanding temporarily. And he was preparing the 1st CMRs to go on the first daylight raid that had ever been put on the Western Front. So I said, oh well, can I go with the battalion bombers? And he says, no, you can't go with the battalion bombers, you have to go with the company, and I don't think you can go at all, you've only just arrived. However, we practiced over tapes and models the best way we could, and finally we went up the line on motor buses to the head of the trench, and the second CMRs were in the line, and they were going to hold the line, and we were to go in there, make our raid, and come out. So I went in with the raiding party, and I...
Excuse me, how much of a march would that be from the end of the communications trench up to the...
About a mile and a bit winding.
Right.
Yeah, right. Zigzag.
Yeah.
So, however, then we were all were put into a tunnel, and we were supposed to come out and see the crater. Well, just as I was the last coming out of the crater party, the then second in command, Major Maxwell, gave me a thing with some tape wound on it and said, now look here, you put this tape across no man's land so that to guide the people and know how to come back. So I didn't go with the crater party. I tied the tape to a barbed wire stake, and I went over the top, and I heard the crater party doing a lot of bombing and shooting and one thing and another. And I had trouble untangling this bloody tape, and I finally got it undone, and it only reached about two-thirds of the way across no man's land. So then I ran like the Dickens and got into the trench and followed another party that was already in the trench. And the drill was to come to a German dugout, and you put stink bombs down, and then you met the Germans coming up with Mills bombs and blew them back down, and then you put down a mobile charge, which was really a Stokes bomb.
Yeah, what was that be, about 5-10 pounds of sort of gun cotton?
About 5, 6 or 8 pounds.
A gun cotton sort of?
Full of aminol.
Aminol, oh yes.
And anyway, it blew up the whole dugout, so nobody could come up and down the stairs, you know. So, well, we did 3 dugouts like that. And then we finally got as far into the trenches as anybody, I think, and then we got the word to come back, so we came back hella hooping, and I didn't see my tape anywhere, but I got back to our own line somehow or other.
The object of this was supposed to pick up prisoners or
Oh yeah. The idea was to capture prisoners, yes. That was the idea. And although we didn't capture any, the whole 3 companies went over, I think. We captured 52 prisoners. One of them was an officer who got a bit canary, so they knocked him on the head. So they got 51 prisoners, and I think we lost 5 killed and about 10 wounded, I think.
Oh, pretty. You must have had the
We must have done in 200. Germans down in their dugouts.
So you achieved complete surprise.
Oh yeah.
How fast did they react to this sudden thing? The guns or the machine guns.
Well, we put down a tremendous box barrage. 18 pounders supplied the front end of the box, and the Vickers machine guns and trench mortars supplied the sides of the box.
I see.
So we went in. We did all our dirty work in the middle of this box.
No reinforcements get through, and I suppose
nobody could come and help them or anything else. So we practically scuppered everybody in the box.
I see. Yes. Yeah. And got your prisoner, so you get some information.
The identification, and that was the idea of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then we came out and we got in the buses, and I remember. I don't know whether this is very interesting or not. Coming back on the buses, I was, it was dark, and I was pretty tired, and I was up on the top of the bus, right up in front.
An open bus, I suppose.
Open top bus.
Double-decker, yeah.
And I was leaning my arms on the rail round, and with my head on the top, and while we were going along, an electric telephone wire was sagging over the road, and the electric wire hit me on the steel helmet and went ping like that, and if I'd been sitting upright, of course it would have taken my head off
right out of the chin. Wow. Amazing stroke of
an extraordinary land. Not only did it ping like that, the bus was under it with all the other soldiers in the back before it had come down again.
You acted as a deflector.
However, we then got back and I made several other trips in the line with the first CMRs, trenches and one thing and another, and then while we were out at rest, preparing for Vimy Ridge, by the way, there was word passed around that they were forming a Canadian machine gun corps to amalgamate all the Vickers machine gun companies, there was one to each brigade, and they wanted more officers. And so I applied, and cut a long story short, after a couple of courses, I found myself an officer in the 8th Brigade Machine Gun Company.
Now, how did this precisely, you volunteered for this, and how did you become an officer? Who recommended you, and what did you, go to school or anything?
Yes, I had to go, well, my colonel had to recommend me. I applied, and my uncle, I think, helped me with my application.
Yeah.
So the colonel said, all right, we'll put his name in. Then we had to appear in front of the brigade commander. And then I had to go in front of Brigadier Brutinel, who is the Corps Machine Gun Officer, Corps Headquarters. And he apparently approved of me. And anyway, then I was sent to the Corps School at Burns, where one did infantry drill and discipline, and I remember I got my name on the board as being the best cadet.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Something of the sort.
Yeah.
And then I went down to Camier, where I took a machine gun course on the Vickers machine gun, and then my commission came through. And I became an officer in the 8th Brigade Machine Gun Company.
Would you like to say a word or two about the use of the machine gun? Machine gun barrages, firing on fixed lines, all this sort of something.
We did everything with machine gun. I have a map there at Passchendaele, for instance. I had command of a battery of 8 machine guns, and we fired a creeping barrage way behind the enemy lines, because the trajectory was not high enough to put it very close behind.
What would you be firing at? 1,500 yards? 2,000
yards? Yes, 1,500 to 2,000 yards.
Yes, that is a long one, yes.
And, we fired a creeping barrage with machine gun. We also, of course, for defensive purposes, we used them crossfire.
Yeah.
We would also back up infantry, follow them up, if they ran up into any opposition, we'd try and come into action and silence the opposition with machine gun fire, if possible.
Did you go into sort of things that, such as harassing fire, for example? So many people on fixed lines, that sort of thing?
Oh yes, we did.
I don't know anything about it, but I...
yes, we did quite a bit of harassing fire. Yeah. That was very often after one of these barrages that we fired.
I see. What sort of expenditure of ammunition would you encounter?
At Passchendaele, with my 8 guns, I fired 350,000 rounds.
Good heavens. Yeah.
And I should have fired more, but my reins so, and my belts were so wet, and you couldn't get the rounds in the belts, the guns just wouldn't work in the rain.
No, I see. In a machine gun battery, you had your 8 crews of what, 3 men to a crew?
About 6.
Oh, 6, because you added so many to pass the ammunition, I suppose?
Yeah.
And I suppose an awful lot of men in a machine gun battery were, in fact, ammunition carriers.
Mostly. Well, over half of them were.
Were they? Yeah. And how much could a man carry? Boxes, I suppose?
It used to take 2 men to carry a box of 1,000 rounds.
Mm-hmm. And Did you get them loose and have to fill your own belts, or did they come with belts?
No, they were they came in belts, carrying belts, nothing to do with machine gun belts.
Mm-hmm.
We had to fill all our own belts.
I see. Well, that kept you busy then.
Well, there was a belt filling machine, which took a bit of working, and it was a hell of a job to work, of course, in a trench, which was full of mud, and was on an ammunition box which wouldn't stay steady. So, most of the filling was done by hand.
Well, that's a long.
And when the belts were wet, of course, you couldn't get the rungs right the way in.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you get a jam on the machine, or
that's
and
then you'd have jam.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That's interesting. Well, to go back to your end of your term then, or time at the being trained as a machine gun officer, what happened to you after you finished?
After finished training, I went into the line for the first time, and we fired some harassing fire. I think I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I think it was harassing fire. And then we came out. We were only in the line for 2 or 3 days. Then we went up and we went to Passchendaele, and that was my second trip in the line. And that's where I had this awful time. I mean, we fired in one barrage and then had to move the guns forward to another place and fire another one. And I got wounded there, and the other officer was blown to pieces with a whole gun crew, and I finally was sent out, and I landed up in hospital, and finally landed back in England.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then.
Just to go back to Passchendaele for a moment, you said you fired 350,000 rounds. Over what period of time was that? Was that a beam? A day or 2 days?
Well, each gun fired at the rate of 4,000 rounds a minute. And I had 8 guns, so they would fire how many rounds a minute for it? 32,000 rounds a minute.
Sure, they didn't fire that fast.
Four
4,000 rounds a minute?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, a gun would fire the right or right.
What sort of effective rate was that? I mean, you didn't hold the
4,000 rounds a minute. Just a minute, not 4,000 rounds a minute. No.
400, perhaps.
No. See, the guns would fire 600 rounds a minute.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wrong. It would be, what was it? It was 4,000 rounds. Maybe it was 4,000 rounds an hour.
On a set schedule,
on a program. Because you didn't fire 600 rounds as hard as you could go all the time.
Your barrel would melt, I would
think.
Yeah,
absolutely,
right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, you change the barrels when they got too hot anyway. But, I think it was 4,000 rounds an hour, I think, was it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we were at it for hours, several hours. And then moving forward and firing another.
Do you find you needed extra men to move in that kind of, those kind of that terrain to carry the guns? I mean, normally you might have.
Yeah, well.
Were 2 men required to do the work of one in good weather, good conditions? Or what was the, did you find that was a problem?
It was, I can't quite remember how.
Conditions were pretty bad anyway.
The conditions, the mud was up to your knees, and here we were. I remember moving forward to locate the new gun positions, and here were British infantry lying dead in waves in the mud.
It must have been a devil job finding a secure place to sight your gun.
The trouble was that we took wooden T bases up, But then, when I moved my guns forward, I couldn't unbend the T-bases, so we filled sandbags and did the best, made as firm a footing as we could with sandbags up in the next position.
Well, how long were you in hospital after you were, when you were wounded? You went to England. And
yeah, well, I was there for a number of months, 6-7 months, I think.
Oh, were you?
And I kept parading to the colonel to get back to the front, and he wouldn't let me. And then right after the 21st of March, the German offensive, of course, we were all sent back again. Mm-hmm. So I got back to the, which by this time was the 3rd Division Machine Gun Battalion. And
it was 1918 then, was it?
So this would be in 1918.
In the spring sometime. Yeah.
And we went in the line a number of times. And then finally, as I say, we went over the top once at Monchy-le-Preux, I remember. And then I got transferred and given command of a battery in another company. So I took that battery into the line. And on the way up, lost all the horses.
And to shell fire?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And had to go around. I could see myself going around with a smoking revolver, shooting wounded horses.
Oh dear me!
And then I had to move forward the best I could with the troops carrying this thing. But I sent back for more horses, and they sent me up some puny little mules. It needs 4 horses to pull a, what we call a fighting limber with all the guns in it, and they sent me 2 miserable little mules. Well, and a mule won't pull if it can't do it. A horse will pull till it's dead, but a mule won't. And however, somehow or other, we got up to the appointed place just about the time of 0 hour, and I can remember we all went over the top again, and I remember a certain exhilaration. Imagine it, of course, I was only
after all this time, yes.
I was only a youngster. Yeah. Here was I, exhilarated, going over the top for the 5th time.
Now, what are the machine guns, they go with the the first wave, the second wave, and the third wave, or what?
We went behind the third wave of the 42nd Battalion.
I see.
That's who we were supporting. Yeah. And however, we finally got up to some barbed wire, and I could see the 42nd Battalion in kilts running around ahead of me a few hundred yards in front.
They still had kilts, did they?
Yeah. And I can remember finding a gap in this barbed wire and trying to set the example. I sauntered through the gap instead of running through it.
Running like hell, yeah.
And I reasoned that bending over, you were just as likely to get hit as
standing up. Yeah.
So I sauntered through standing up. And it had a necessary moral effect, because when I waved them, all the rest of them came through. All bent over, by the way. But however, then I was lying down making a plan to go up and support the right flank of the 42nd Battalion, and I got lying down, I got hit in the shoulder.
Oh, for goodness sake, yeah.
And I couldn't go on any further, so I crawled over to the only remaining officer. The other one had been wounded, coming over the open country, and I gave him my map, and I described everything that was to happen, and then I left. I understand that as far as he ever got. I understand he never did another damn thing. But however,
and were you able to? Were you mobile enough to go back under your own?
Yeah, I walked. Oh, you walked. Yeah, I hit you through the shoulder, and I went all the way back.
I suppose it was just as dangerous walking back as it was walking forward.
It wasn't
it?
Very. There was a machine gun up in the church tower at a place called St. Ollie, I think, on the outskirts of Cambrai. I think that's, he was the fellow who did all the damage. Oh, yeah. Anyway, I managed to get back to my company headquarters and report and tell them exactly what had happened, what everyone, gave him a complete resume of the situation. And then I went to a dressing station in Bourlon Wood, I remember, which had been captured from the Germans. And a German doctor looked after me, and a little German came up and gave me some tea, and another German came along and gave me some coffee, and then a friend of mine came along and gave me a drink of brandy, and then I was told to go out and sit in a certain place. And I sort of passed out, I guess from lack of blood or something.
Yeah, a shock or something.
And then I woke up in an ambulance. Yeah.
That's interesting that as you move forward, you captured this outfit, and then the Germans that were put to work by...
Well, medical people would do that.
And they were perfectly happy to do it. Well, that's very interesting. Using the German equipment or using your own? Did you just?
It was a German dressing station that we'd taken over, I think.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't know what they used.
One hears that the German medical supplies by that time were somewhat less than adequate, and I wondered whether.
I'm not sure about. Yeah. All I know is that I received enough.
Yeah. Attention to.
And as I say, I finally woke up on a stretcher near a row of boxcars. Eventually I was put on a boxcar on the stretcher and we went down
to a
I woke up, I landed in a casualty clearance station, and while I was lying, and there were nurses there, that's how far, it was far enough back in the proper hospital, tent hospital. And I was lying in bed half awake, and I heard a most unmistakable ha 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 right across the room. Feet to feet with me was my uncle, who had just been wounded within half an hour and half a mile of me.
Oh, for heaven's sake. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're back in the same casualty clearance
station. Here we were back in the same casualty clearance station.
Let me go back a little bit. You mentioned you brought your machine guns up to the line on limbers. I wonder if you could describe what they were. How many machine guns to a limber? Were they stored in boxes, or were they stored in... what would they describe, one if you wouldn't?
Well, a limbered wagon was two boxes on wheels hitched together with a wagon tongue.
Basically an artillery limber.
It was a limbered wagon. Okay. It was a box. And in that box, the front half of it was two machine guns in their boxes. They fitted in boxes. And probably about 250 rounds to a box, so about 5,000 rounds of ammunition in belts boxes, spare parts cases, and various other things which I've forgotten about. And then in the rear limber was more ammunition in bulk, and spare belts and the spare both the limbers were sufficiently full that it took four horses
to pull them.
They were called the fighting limbers. In a battery there were four fighting limbers, that is eight guns, and
two auxiliary limbers, and anyway, all together there were 26 horses.
Mm-hmm.
Only one horse was for the battery commander to ride, yeah, so there was there were 26 horses in the battery anyway.
Yeah. Well, by 1918, I suppose your equipment, your uniform, your equipment, your webbing gear, the amount that one carried was vastly different in the way of than in say 1916. It had changed quite a bit, and left a lot of gear, intended to leave gear behind and load yourself with ammunition and that sort of thing. Was that
they still
carried all this stuff?
They still carried, the infantry still carried the same silly amount, I think.
The reason I asked, I seem to me I had read somewhere where as the story unfolded, one got the impression that the infantryman, for example, carried more ammunition, he carried more Mills bombs.
Yeah.
Rather than, he started out with two, although by the end they were carrying six or eight and this sort of thing, and I wondered
whether it was too much weight. In the Second War, that there was more, of course they had mechanical transport in the Second War, but there was more of the idea of we're going to do a job where we will carry what we need for this job, and we'll leave all the rest of the stuff behind.
It'll catch up to us.
It'll catch up in the motor lorries.
But in Europe, this type of war, of course,
it was horse-drawn, so it would never catch up.
No.